From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are probably times you felt a tinge of guilt for not doing more charitable work. But there are those, of course, who do spend their time working at the homeless shelter, passing out coats on the street, and aren't we glad someone is doing it? But if we're honest, there's another feeling we have for the people who devote their lives to helping others. What's wrong with them? The journalist Larissa Mafarker has written a book that examines the lives of people who have made these really extreme commitments of service to others, and she describes them as relentless and idealistic and hopeful, and for some reason, we are suspicious of them. Mafarker is joining us today to explain why, and to help us work through some really big questions like just how much can morality demand of you? Join us after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Larissa Mafarker has written a book exploring the do-gooder. It's not the best word for it, but it does help express the conflicting emotions we have for these idealistic, relentless people. Mafarker is not talking about a part-timer, by the way. If you read to kids in a hospital once a week or you deliver meals to the elderly on Fridays, you don't qualify. She's talking about people who devote their lives, devote pretty much everything to others. This is a person, she says, who is drawn to moral goodness for its own sake, someone who pushes himself to moral extremity. This is a person whose sense of duty is so strong they can put aside comfort and family. And the book is full of intimate stories, the lives of really extraordinary people and why they do the things they do. It's also, though, about why the rest of us feel uneasy and sometimes suspicious about these people and their impulses. The book is called Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. And Larissa Mafarker has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1998. Larissa Mafarker, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Doug.
When did you first start thinking about this? Before it became a book idea, were you thinking a lot about this idea?
Well, you know, I've always been, as I think, you know, many people are, kind of preoccupied with the question of how much I ought to be doing. How much can morality require of me? Am I doing enough? I mean, well, I wasn't wondering that. I knew I wasn't doing enough, even by my own lights. But I began to read philosophy. I really enjoy reading particularly sort of Anglo-American moral philosophy. And there is a debate in that philosophical world over the question of demandingness. How much can morality demand of us? And on the one hand, there are some people like the most famous is the philosopher Peter Singer, whose morality is about as demanding as it gets. It requires, in essence, that you keep giving to others until you are as badly off as the worst off person in the world. Now, Singer himself, you know, is a fairly practical man. He doesn't always advocate that you actually do that, but that's the logic of his philosophy.
Right.
But on the other hand, there are other philosophers like the late Bernard Williams, who was an Oxford philosopher, a really extraordinary, a beautiful writer, who made a plea for the other side that said, you know, if morality is that stringent, if it requires us to give everything, if we are nothing but servants of the world, then most of what we love about human life will have to be abandoned. You know, there's no time in that schema for love of one's family. There's no time for art. There's no time for work that you love other than serving others. You know, everything has to go.
Yeah.
And so I was very torn between these two arguments and wanted to explore it. And I thought, well, I don't want to think about this only in the abstract. I want to look at actual lives, look at the lives of people who have pushed their morality almost as far as it's possible to push it and see what those lives look like. Do they look as desiccated, as bleak as Bernard Williams would have us believe? Or did they look like lives that were joyful and full of purpose? I didn't know. And so I set out to find people like that.
Were you expecting in some ways to be a little annoyed by some of these people? And I mean in the sense that this does get to the ambivalence you write about. But were you expecting to be all right already? Do you have to really give – I mean, I have to say, reading the stories, there were moments when I was like, oh, come on, Charles Gray. Oh, come on, Dorothy, really? You know what I mean? I mean, were you expecting that?
Of course. You know, I wasn't. I mean, I completely understand it, and I know that it's there, which is why I use the term do-gooder. As you said, it's not a very nice term, but it gets at the suspicion and the even hostility that I'm talking about, and we can talk about that later. But I didn't go into this expecting to be annoyed. I came into it on the contrary, on sides. I wanted to – I was thinking I was going to defend these do-gooders against the annoyance of others because – you know, I get that there are certain character traits that often, though not always, go with being a do-gooder, like self-righteousness or being judgmental of other people or being kind of prissy or puritanical. And now, mind you, I don't think that the people I wrote about have those qualities, but they definitely are associated with a person who lives a very moral life. And I agree that those qualities are really annoying, but I do think that we overvalue them. You know, imagine – you know, there's a person who devotes his whole life to helping the homeless, and he's kind of puffed up and self-righteous about it. And imagine, on the other hand, another person who never does anything for anyone but is delightful and cynical and fun to have a drink with.
Right.
Are we really going to say that the first person is worse?
Yeah.
Surely
yeah.
not.
Yeah.
You know, so I get that those qualities are annoying, but I really think that we go too far when we say, well, you know, do-gooders tend to be self-righteous, therefore they're bad.
The other thing that was interesting, and maybe we should talk about – I want to jump into some of these stories. Let's talk about Dorothy Granada, who's mm-hmm. – I don't know. It's hard to say who's my favorite.
Oh, good.
I loved a lot, and we'll try to talk to us about as many of these stories as we can. Just set us up. Tell us who Dorothy is. It's a kind of an extraordinary life. I mean, where she's been and the things she's seen and her courage is mm-hmm. really remarkable. But I want to talk about who she was, but give us a sense of who she was first.
Yeah. Well, she lived – I mean, it seems to me she lived about four or five different lives. She was born in L.A. She was the daughter of immigrants. Her mother was Mexican. Her father was from the Philippines. She never really knew her father. He abandoned her mother very early on. She grew up extremely poor. Her mother had her at 16, I think it was selling apples on the street to support her younger brothers. I mean, really is dirt poor. And she grew up – she was abused as a child. I mean, she had a terrible, terrible childhood. But she formed the goal early on of becoming a nurse. And she knew that in order to become a nurse, she had to graduate from high school. So she did. And she went to nursing school. And she, in the first part of her life, built a middle-class life for herself. She emerged from poverty. She was a very good nurse. And she, at one point – found herself in an American military hospital in Germany where she met a kind of aristocratic, waspy guy who was an American Army officer and married him. And they moved back to Chicago and she became this middle-class wife. But then she and her husband got divorced and she thought, you know, this is not the life for me. I want to serve. And I also am sick of being the only brown person in a white world. So at first she went to work for Mexicans in the barrio in Chicago. But then she moved to the West Coast. And in 1978, when she was in her late 40s, she suddenly had a revelation in church. She was a religious Catholic for the first part of her life. And she suddenly realized, Jesus wants me to resist violence and stand with the poor. It's so simple. That is the two things he wants of me. And she suddenly realized, well, that's what I have to do. So she set out to do both those things. For her, resisting violence, she thought, well, the most violent thing I can think of is a nuclear bomb. And she was living in Oregon. There weren't nuclear bombs in Oregon, you'll be glad to know. But there were nuclear power plants. And so she joined groups of people who were protesting nuclear power. And ultimately, she ended up participating with her second husband in what they called the Fast for Life. It was an internationally organized fast, open-ended fast, possibly to the death, to protest nuclear missiles deployed by America in Europe, Pershing and cruise missiles. And ultimately, they called off the fast at day 40. You know, she was almost – she was going blind. She was very – she was approaching death. They called it off because at that point, a Korean airliner was shot down by the Soviets. And it was this terrible moment in the Cold War. And it became very clear to Dorothy, you know, this is not a time when nuclear weapons are going to be disarmed. You know, this is this is pointless. That was – so that was the violence part. And then she also felt that she wanted to stand with the poor. And to her, she felt that meant becoming poor again. And this was very hard for her because she came from the ghetto and she did not want to go back. But she thought, I must do this. So she gave away everything she owned. She lived a very, very frugal, bare-bones life, spending with her husband $1,200 a year in America. And then ultimately, it's, you know, I'm abbreviating a very complex and long story, but ultimately she decided after the fast for life was over and they decided not to fast to the death, she said, you know, I want to go and be a nurse again and I want to nurse my people. And to her, that meant Latina women. And she ended up working in a very dangerous war zone in rural Nicaragua, founding a clinic for rural women who, you know, had no medical help whatsoever. And she stayed there for the rest of her life. Well, she's still living there. She's now she's now 85, and that was what she devoted the second half of her life to.
What's interesting about – well, a lot of things are interesting about Dorothy. One of the things you point out early on in that story is that for Dorothy, this wasn't about trying to purify herself. She was more interested in the – I mean for her husband, for Charles, her husband – purity was sort of a thing. She didn't care about that. She admitted to liking nice things. Every once in a while, she thought she would it would be nice to have a new pair of shoes. She didn't really have disdain necessarily for nice things. She was less about the purity thing. She was more about the justice part, which I found really interesting.
Absolutely, because – and, you know, I chose her partly for that reason because – I wanted the people in this book to be people I wholeheartedly admired, and I wanted them to be challenging. And I knew, you know, you could find any number of people out there, I'm sure, who are on extreme moral crusades that seem kind of silly or kind of annoying, you know. And for me, the quest for personal purity, I just am not interested in it. And so what I loved about Dorothy is that she didn't think it was important what she did for what she herself did for its own sake, but she thought, I need to stand with the poor because it's about justice. And she wasn't at all pure. She was very loose. She said, you know, when she decided to throw in her lot with her second husband and engage in this very, very frugal way of living for the sake of justice, she said, you know what, I will do this. And she had fun doing it. She loved dumpster diving. She thought it was fun. She thought it was an adventure. But she said, you know what? I've got to have my glass of wine in the evening and I've got to have my coffee. And it, don't even talk to me about giving up those things. And, you know, she grew up poor. So she had a – this is not some, you know, middle class dilettante who thought, oh, I'm going to simplify my life. Money is evil. Not at all. She grew up poor. She knew how important money was. And that's exactly why she felt it was the right thing to do, to stand with the poor.
So what's the thing that do-gooders lack? This is how you put it in the book later on. You say that do-gooders lack innocence. They lack – this is also how you put it. They lack that happy blindness that allows most people to shut their minds to all the misery out there. If you're thinking about – a lot of us react to a Facebook feed that'll have a really sad photo of a, you know, a child in famine or something like that. What you're saying is they don't need the photo.
Exactly right.
Talk about that. What is the thing they have? This is the interesting part for me.
Well, you know, it's almost. I mean, I think they're different from us in a number of ways. But this is one thing that I came to realize was incredibly important. And it's not really a moral quality. It's almost an aesthetic quality. It's a quality of an extra powerful imagination that, you know, take something very immediate, the refugee crisis in Europe, right? We all know what's going on. We all know that thousands and thousands of people are in very dire situations in refugee camps, struggling along in now freezing weather, taking with them children, babies. I mean, it's just an awful situation. But many people in the world didn't really feel that suffering until they saw that photo, you know, that everyone in the world saw of that toddler drowned off the coast of Greece, which I think, you know, appeared in August. And for a moment, everyone gasped. It was as though the whole world said, oh, now we see. But yes, this is the difference. You see, the people I'm writing about, they feel it. They have this ability to conjure up what it feels like to be suffering. And that is such a vivid and urgent feeling for them that they feel as driven to help people they know are suffering, even if those people are far away, in the same way that most of us would only feel if there was someone really right in front of us. Mm-hmm. You know, if we saw someone fall in the road and get their foot run over by a car, I think probably anyone would gasp in horror and run to help. They feel that all the time. And, you know, it's on the one hand a very morally beautiful feeling to be able to hold someone's suffering in your head and feel it as though it's your own. On the other hand, it can be, if not properly managed, it can be crippling. It can be paralyzing. You know, imagine that someone was being run over by a car in front of you all the time. You couldn't take a – you know, you're trying to get to work. You're trying to take your children to school and you can't do it because there's somebody being run over by a car every second of the day. You can't function. You can't function. And so, you know, one of the important things that the people I'm writing about have to do, each one of them, and usually because these are successful do-gooders I'm writing about, they manage to do it early on in life, they have to figure out some way to establish limits for themselves. Right. You know, most of us don't need to establish limits because we don't feel that urgency in the way that these people do. We only feel it occasionally when we hear about some big crisis, but they have to establish that if they're going to retain their sanity and their commitment in the long term, they can't be rescuing 24 hours a day.
You put it this way. You say codifying their horror into a routine and a set of habits they can't live with. I mean, you've got to make it manageable.
Exactly.
Right.
You have to. And this is really hard for some of them. I mean, for instance, you know, there's a woman I write about, a young woman, and this is an exciting couple to write about, Julia Wise and Jeff Kaufman.
Right.
Exciting because, you know, whereas the other people I was talking about them, talking with them about their lives as they remembered them. But with Julia and Jeff, I met them when they were 25 and they were making these enormous moral decisions, life decisions, as in the course of our conversations. Julia, for instance, had to make two very large decisions, the same decisions that are crucial decisions for anyone. What shall I do with my life? And should I have children? And the first one was difficult for her because she believes, because she's not any more valuable than anyone else, that she's obliged to give away as much of her money as she possibly can to help people who are in desperate need. And she had always wanted to be a social worker. But she knows, of course, that social workers make very little money. So she struggled with this decision. Is this a morally acceptable decision? Because if she were to become something else, she was a very well-educated woman. She could have become a corporate lawyer, say, and earned way more money and given away far more money and saved more lives. Was it okay for her to become a social worker? This is a very difficult question for her. Now, for most of us, we think, oh, my gosh, how can it not be a good thing to be a social worker? But you see her logic, you know. It's – is there a difference between choosing not to earn more money and, on the other hand, earning a lot of money and just spending it on stupid stuff like buying lots of sofas or high-heeled shoes or something? So that was one of her struggles. And she ultimately, for sanity's sake, decided to become a social worker. The other struggle was, should I have children? Because, again, she realized that having a child would be the most expensive, non-essential thing she could possibly have. And so it would require – even though she'd be a very frugal mother, it would still require a lot of her resources. And so she reasoned that, you know, she doesn't – again, this is what I mean by lacking happy blindness. She put it very, very starkly as possible. She said, if I have a child, I will be in effect, by having a child of my own, killing other people's children, because I will be spending money on that child that I do not spend to help save the lives of other kids. And, you know, if you imagine seeing it like that, you can imagine the struggle it was for her. And she thought about other options like foster care, adoption, et cetera. But And again, ultimately she thought, you know, I'm doing the best I can.
Right.
If I don't have a child, that is the point at which my life feels so bleak to me that I'm in danger of losing my moral commitment altogether. So she decided, I'm going to have a child and I will give away everything I possibly can. Also, her husband, who's very pragmatic, he said, you know, if we have a child, the chances are its beliefs will be pretty similar to ours. It will feel also obliged to give away a fair amount of money. And even though it may not be quite as extreme as we are.
It's more money.
If we assume. Yeah, yes, absolutely. And so, you know, if he made a calculation. He's a programmer. He makes everything in terms of mathematical calculations in a way that I find hilarious and charming. He made a calculation that if the child regressed to the mean by, say, 10%, it was 10% less generous than they were, the amount they could reasonably expect that the child would be a net profit for charity because it would probably give away more money than they spent on its upbringing. Now, of course, very few people think about having children in these terms, but this is what's demanded once you start thinking about what you owe to strangers.
What's interesting, too, is, you know, you have the Peter Singers who are the pure utilitarians,
mm-hmm.
And you write about this as a principle. And then you have people who are – they sort of get up to the border of utilitarianism, but then they kind of back off on it. And you say that – what interests me, though, is that our reaction to it, to the idea that this kind of commitment, as you put it in the book, is not just really demanding and inconvenient and hard for most of us, but that it's actually evil. And you yourself write that this to accept this idea of utilitarianism, you have to reject a core part of what most people believe, almost reject that natural part of you. I mean, I guess this really gets at why so many of us are so ambivalent to all of this.
Well, utilitarianism is a very severe doctrine that very few people, even
right.
very few do-gooders, subscribe to. I mean, the basic idea of utilitarianism is that you should do the most good you possibly can, and that what matters is the net amount of welfare, I guess, or happiness or something like that in the world, not rules like you must never lie, you must never kill someone. So for instance, a very strict utilitarian – and mind you, I don't know if there has ever been such a strict utilitarian – but in principle, a very strict utilitarian would say it would be correct to kidnap someone – just some random innocent person walking down the street, kill him, harvest all his organs and eyes and everything and use them to save the lives of – well, if we count out how many organs we have, we can figure out how many lives we'd save, you know, five or six. And that would be right because five people or six people would live and one person would die. But most people say, no, actually, I'm not going to go that far. I see the logic of it, but it's still wrong to kill an innocent person. Most people don't subscribe to that. But, you know, it's still a very demanding doctrine even if you don't go all the way, to think that you are required to do as much good as you possibly can, which means there's never a point, which most of us feel like intuitively that there is, at which you can say, okay, I've done my duty for today.
Yeah.
Now the rest of my time, the money I have left over, my attention, I can do with as I like. I can now go read a book or spend time with my kids or something like that. No.
Yeah, it's never over. Your life is the duty.
It's never over. Yeah. You are a slave to the world.
Right. Larissa Mafarker is with us. She's a staff writer, of course, for The New Yorker, and her book is Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Larissa Mafarker. We're talking about her book, Strangers Drowning. It's a book that profiles people who are living these lives of extreme ethical commitment. So this idea that that something's wrong with these people, you write about sort of the history of that sense of ambivalence. And you say it's not a new idea, really. I mean, there's always been people who have figured that do-gooders are kind of going overboard and we wonder about their motives. But what seems to be like a relatively new idea you write about is that when people are doing these good things, even for really good reasons, there's still a problem with them. That's something you write about that's relatively new. And I wanted to ask you about this. This sort of gets us to the story of this man named Bernard Mandeville, who writes this book called The Fable of the Bees. I wanted you to talk about that.
Well, yeah, I was, as I said earlier, very struck by the skepticism that I encountered about these do-gooders. And I wanted to get at the history of that. And one strand that I found, I just began, this is, there could be many histories, but this is the one I started with, was with Bernard de Mandeville, who was a doctor in London in the 18th century. And he wrote a book which in many ways presaged the Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. It was an argument that in this new capitalist market society, what used to be virtue was no longer virtue. In fact, was a bad thing, because if people were all self-denying and self-abnegating and frugal, the market would collapse. The economy would collapse and everyone would suffer. So what was required in this new society is that people be extravagant, buy themselves frivolous things, do all the things, waste money, do the things that used to be thought to be vices. Now they were virtues. And this idea was, as you can imagine, thought totally outrageous, because this is in the early days of capitalism. Now it would not seem so crazy. We understand that a certain amount of spending is necessary to bolster the economy, and that doesn't seem so weird. But back then, you know, to be told it's virtuous to spend your money on frivolous things, it just sounded insane. But then this idea became incorporated into – he was a very funny writer and was almost sounded just satirical. It was hard to know to what extent he was being serious. But then came The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith's book, which was one of the founding texts of capitalism, right, as we know. And that codified this idea within a much more serious examination of how capitalism worked, the idea being that each person by himself acting in a self-interested way, in a basically a selfish way, trying to make his own profit and increase his own wealth, combined with many, many other people doing the same thing, would do as much good for the economy, for society as a whole, as if he were trying to be selfless and trying to help the society as a whole on purpose. And this was put in this new sober form, a very strikingly new idea, the idea that a selfish person might be able to do more good for others than a selfless one. And this idea kind of took many forms in the centuries that followed. I mean, we're talking in the 18th century still, but, you know, jump forward a century and you get to Darwin and the Origin of the Species. And here was an argument that evolution, the basic mechanism of life, proceeded according to a selfish struggle for survival. And so it looked like how could, you know, altruism doesn't fit in that picture. How can altruism be natural to a creature whose basic mechanism of life is selfish struggle? Now, Darwin had an answer to that question. Right. Darwin did not believe that altruism was unnatural. He believed that altruism made perfect sense in the context of evolution, because groups of people who are prepared to sacrifice for one another, who are altruistic, would prosper more than groups of just purely selfish individuals who had no interest in helping one another. So he called this group selection. But now I don't, you know, for some reason this was not found convincing by biologists for more than a century. It was dismissed, and they biologists and evolutionary psychologists came up with ways, you know, they saw that there were altruistic people in the world. They had to explain this completely mystifying fact, and so they came up with various rationales like kin selection. You know, if you appear to be altruistic, you're actually just trying to preserve your genes through helping your family. Or reciprocal altruism. You might appear to be being selfless, but actually you're just trying to arrange a kind of quid pro quo. If you help somebody, you expect they'll help you next. And so it's all really selfishness in disguise. And it wasn't until very recently that some biologists like David Sloan Wilson and E.O. Wilson have been reviving Darwin's idea of group selection and saying, you know what, actually it does make sense after all. And altruism does appear to be a natural part of the human character.
You tell the story of Samuel Oliver and his wife, Pearl. I mean, they're trying to make sense of the Holocaust, helped them get a sense of it.
Yes, that was very, very interesting. These are a pair of sociologists, a married couple who worked in the Holocaust. Samuel Oliver was a Holocaust survivor himself. He had been helped by a Catholic woman who took him in and trained him in Catholic catechism and customs in order to pass as a Christian for the duration of the war. And later when he grew up, he was a boy then, he wondered why did she do that? That put herself at risk. Her own family was at risk. And it wasn't like, you know, everyone was patting her on the back. Quite the contrary. So why did she do that? And he made a study of rescuers and non-rescuers, those who helped the Jews and those who did not. And he found that it wasn't that the ones who didn't help the Jews were necessarily anti-Semitic. Many of them felt compassionate towards the Jews and felt that what was happening to them in Germany and Austria and Poland, et cetera, was very wrong. That wasn't the difference. The difference was very interesting. It was that he found that often the people who did not rescue had been raised in a very traditional, strict household, and that had left them feeling kind of helpless. Mm. They felt that they were so hemmed in by rules and by authority figures that there was really nothing they could do to change the way the world was arranged, whereas the people who did rescue had grown up in more lenient households where they'd been given a lot of freedom and a lot of love, and this had left them feeling that they did have some control over their environment. They felt empowered to do something, that if they did something, it might work, that if they saw something that was going wrong, they might fix it. And, you know, as you can imagine, I have young kids. I thought, that's really something to remember. That's a really an extraordinary finding.
Well, so you have the biological part that seems to be making way for altruism. Let's talk about the psychological or the psychoanalytical part, which you write about, because for decades we figured do-gooders had some sort of pathological condition, you know, severe masochism or narcissism or control issues. But you say that psychologists have started to see their way around to another idea that maybe there is a really very normal kind of altruism psychologically.
Yes, it's the tide is turning in the social sciences, and I don't know why, but it is. There are psychologists like Jonathan Haidt at NYU who is studying altruism as a normal psychological process, and many psychologists and even psychoanalysts, you know, psychoanalysis in the tradition of Freud and Anna Freud even more so, was really the most extreme defender of altruism as a kind of pathology, as you say, as masochism, as Anna Freud thought that somebody who was an altruist was kind of perverted because they could only feel pleasure through a proxy by making someone else happy, and that struck her as perverted. You know, you read this stuff now and you think, gosh, what a terrible way to see humankind. But I think at a certain point in the 20th century, the assumption of human selfishness, the assumption that egotism was at the basis of the human personality was so strong that anything that didn't fit that that theory had to be explained away as selfishness in disguise. And that is changing, and I'm not sure why. And it wasn't just in psychoanalytical theory either. I mean, this suspicion of do-gooders also was present in popular culture, and to some extent it had a different origin, but I think it must have been affected by psychoanalysis because in the mid-century that was such an enormously influential way of thinking. So the one of the other origins I trace it to is Al-Anon because, you know, we all know that Alcoholics Anonymous was one of the groups that introduced this new idea that alcoholism was not a sin as it had always been thought of as, but a disease. Yeah. But Al-Anon introduced an even more radical idea. Al-Anon is the group – it was founded a decade or so after Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was founded by the spouses of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And it formulated the analysis that not only was alcoholism a disease, but trying to help the alcoholic, trying to change the alcoholic and get him to give up drinking was part of the same disease. It was another kind of addiction.
Codependency.
And this, Well, yes, exactly. This started out just narrowly focused on the wives of alcoholics or the spouses, but usually the wives. But then in the 70s or 80s, later, it became this idea of codependency, which was addressed at a much broader phenomenon. All kinds of helping became reinterpreted as controlling. You think you're trying to help someone because you feel compassionate for them and you see them in trouble, but actually you're just trying to control their lives. You're trying to rebuild them in the way that you think they ought to be. You're imposing your own sense of things on them, and it came to look like a kind of sickness, a kind of power hunger, a kind of addiction. You know, all these unhealthy phenomena came to be associated with helping. And I think that also contributed to the sense that there's something wrong with people who try to help too much.
Right. Well, there's another before we head to a break, because I want to get to a couple more stories. But let me just mention, I guess it's the third undermining of do-gooders, and that's novels, literature. Would you say something about that? This idea that there really, and I didn't realize there aren't that many do-gooders in fiction, in novels, for example. I mean, you mentioned George Bernard Shaw and Tolstoy. There are some exceptions, but novelists aren't that interested in altruism, I guess.
It's true. And, you know, I think there's many things behind that. I mean, I find it very frustrating. And part of the motive for this book, one of the many motives for writing this book, was a kind of advertisement to novelists to say, you know, you should write about these people. They're fascinating. Because I think there's this cliche out there that evil is fascinating and complex, whereas goodness is kind of simple and dull. And that's just not true. You know, when I was writing this book, I talked to a novelist friend of mine about this, and I said, you know, why don't novelists write about good people? And he gave me this look like I'd said, you know, why don't you write up a nice book about bunnies and butterflies? And it was so frustrating. No, good people are complex. But there's something more than the suspicion that I'm talking about, that good people are boring. It's a sense in novels that you get over and over and over again. You know, I went looking for do-gooders in novels because I wanted to see what was modern fiction's attitude towards this type of person. And I went to the writers that I thought were most likely to enshrine these people, to have a positive take, like George Eliot, like Tolstoy, like Dostoevsky, like George Bernard Shaw, like Graham Greene, like Iris Murdoch, like, you know, many novelists who are known for writing being interested in goodness. And what I found was interesting to me, which was that there was an interest in goodness, but it was not a do-gooder kind of goodness. It was not the kind of person who sets out to help strangers and push themselves to live as ethical a life as possible. What was framed as good in these novels was somebody who was kind, who was caring about people close to them, who had good impulses in a very local, immediate, day-to-day way. But when it came to people who had more ambitious notions of the good than that, who wanted to push themselves morally to help larger numbers of people, that was always condemned. It's very interesting. You see a character like that, and either they come off as a total idiot, like Mrs. Jellyby in Bleak House. She's the most famous one. There's this brief, hilarious scene in the novel where the narrator comes upon her, and she is going on and on about her great work in her charity in Africa. And meanwhile, her children are dressed in rags, starving to death, falling downstairs. Mrs. Jellyby herself has not even combed her hair. She doesn't care about her family because she cares only about strangers. And you see this – she's only the most obvious example. You see that pattern over and over again in novels, that a character who cares about strangers as opposed to people close to him is suspicious, is either an idiot, is a fool, or is something worse, is somehow violent, is somehow cold and mistreating the people close to him. And it's very interesting. It's as though there is a commitment in fiction to the near, to the close, to the intimate, and a distaste for anything too abstract, too theoretical, too far away.
Larissa Mafarker is with us. Her book is Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Larissa Mafarker. We're talking about her book, Strangers Drowning. So I was hoping to get to like five more of these stories that we're not going to, but I'm going to try. Let's talk about Baba because I loved him. And maybe tell the story, this is the night in the rain, and it's this moment that really changes everything in his life.
Yeah, this was a man who grew up in a very aristocratic family in India in the 20s and 30s. He was born in 1914, and he was very macho. He was kind of a playboy when he was young. He was he had a very fancy car with tiger skin seats, and went to lots of movies, and he was living the life of a young rich guy. But he was also getting into a lot of fights, and was very he was fearless, and this was very important to him. And then one night he was walking along the road, and he saw a leper in the last stages of the disease, and it was really a ghastly sight. You know, the limbs were fallen away and rotted away, and there were maggots crawling in and out of the man's skin. The eyes were caved in. I mean, just a horrifying sight. And at that time, we now know leprosy is not very contagious, but at the time it was thought to be.
Right.
And he was horrified by this ghastly sight, and he ran away. And then he got a little ways down the road, and he realized, I ran away.
Yeah.
I was a coward. And this thought was intolerable to him because this was at the core of his sense of himself, was I am a fearless man. And he was so horrified by this that he went back to the man and he said, I have to conquer this fear. And he went back to the leper and covered him with a piece of cloth to protect him from the rain. And this man was past help and he soon died. But Baba realized, if I am going to preserve the sense of myself as a fearless man, I am going to steer directly into my fear. I am going to make leprosy my life's work. And he did. He went on to found a leprosy colony that even now is a flourishing community that's run by his grandchildren.
Will you read this section a moment here? I just want to give people a sense of your writing and have to read this section, if you would, about this moment. After Baba, as you say in the book, it's the first time in his life he hated himself was after he ran away.
He began with the idea of treating the disease, but later, after he had lived in his colony for many years, he realized that it was not just the alleviation of suffering that excited him, but the suffering itself. He believed that a person who had not felt pain, mental or physical, was incapable of strong attachments, and that shared suffering was the mortar of community. Pain broke a man open and let other people in. Suffering was at the core of what it meant to be human. His colony was held together by the suffering of the lepers, Baba believed. And because he, too, had been in pain for much of his adult life, he had severely degenerative arthritis and was forced to spend time in traction and months in bed. He felt himself part of that fellowship. To me, the kinship of pain has always been the strongest bond, he wrote in a poem. I could forget those with whom I laughed, but I will never forget those with whom I shed tears. His wife wrote, a greater affiliation with pain is what is required and is capable of transforming this world. We need no other religion.
I want to ask you about Itetsu Numoto, another fascinating character. Beautiful, beautiful story. He's a Buddhist priest in Japan who works with people who are contemplating suicide. Let's talk a little bit about him. The course of his life is interesting. He leaves this monastery, wants to get back to the world. And there's a kind of an interesting irony in his story. I mean, he has it's a long story, and I'm sort of synthesizing it, but he has heart trouble at some point, and he's hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who had been helping him, because everyone was reaching out to him for help, they didn't really care about him when they found
mm-hmm.
out that he had been hospitalized. And this seemed really paralyzing, demoralizing for him. Would you talk about that part?
Yeah, this was a kind of a crisis in his life. He had been working for a number of years helping people who felt suicidal, and he was just doing it out of his own home. He wasn't part of an organization. He just – and the word spread that this was a good person to talk to if you were feeling close to death. And many, many people called him, and he would spend hours and hours with them on the phone and over again, you know, night after night, rarely making any progress. And he took in all this pain into himself, and that's one of the reasons that people liked talking to him, because he was deeply compassionate, but he wasn't able to defend himself from the pain of others. And he, as more and more people called him and he got less and less sleep and less – no time for himself, he was under so much stress that he had a very serious heart attack at a young age. I think he was in his 35 or something like that, mid-30s, and he almost died, and he had to have several surgeries. And then he wrote a note on his website. He kept a website. Many people came to him through that, saying, "I've had a heart condition. I'm in the hospital. That's why I haven't been able to get back to you. I'm sorry." And yes, he found when people responded to that note that nobody cared. Everyone – not yeah, probably there were some people, some exceptions, but most people said, "Well, but what about me?
Yeah.
Well, you were helping me. I need your help. I understand you're in the hospital, but I need you. I'm suicidal. You need to call me back." And that was when he realized, you know, I can't do this expecting gratitude. That can't be the motive for my work. I am doing this because I want to do it and I get something out of it. And that is enough for me. That's how I have to think about it. You know, it's interesting. Baba Amte had the same idea. The man who founded the leprosy colony said, you know, I'm doing this for my own reasons. Mm-hmm. And his son, Prakash Amte, founded a clinic in the middle of the forest amongst a group of tribal people called the Madhya Gons who hadn't had medical care before. And this son helped them in the clinic but found it almost impossible to get anyone else to work in the clinic as a doctor or a nurse because the Madhya Gons lived such wretched lives. They were dying all the time. You know, their children would die in childbirth. Their children would die killed by animals in the forest. They would fall into the fire while they were asleep and burn to death. I mean, death was constant. And perhaps because of that constant presence of death, they just didn't seem to have the expected emotions around recovery and illness. You know, someone would be cured after a long struggle and they'd be like, oh well, that's okay. They didn't show emotion of joy. And if someone died, a baby died, they didn't seem to be unhappy. And people couldn't cope with that. They felt that if they had saved someone's life after a long struggle, they there should be, if not gratitude, at least some kind of joy at this outcome. And there wasn't. And Prakash would tell people, you are doing this for your own reasons. You have come here because you want to. And if you think you're doing it, they didn't ask you to come. Right. If you think you are doing it in order to get gratitude from other people, you are going to be disappointed.
You know, at Tetsu, this interesting thing happens in his story. At some point, he stopped doing these, having these consultations with people from a distance. He said, if you want my help, come to me. And the idea that they would have to exert some kind of effort, which you say changed him, but it ended up changing them a lot too.
There was this wonderful story that I love of this man who wrote to him asking for his help. And this was after he'd emerged from the hospital and had instituted this new rule. So he said, you must come to me. And the man lived a long way away and had very little money. So he walked. It took him 5 days to walk from the town where he lived to Nemoto's house. And in the course of those 5 days, he thought and he thought and he walked and he thought about his life and he thought about why he wanted to die. And by the time he got there to Nemoto's house, he said, you know, I've solved my problem. I now know why I want to live. I don't need your help anymore. And he turned around and went home.
Stephanie Weikstra is another one of these stories. We don't have a lot of time to tell her story. I mean, suffice it to say, she rejects Christianity. She rejects philosophy. She rejects utilitarianism and this idea of unlimited altruism. And she reads this book called Radical Acceptance. And I think that this is one of the stories that ends the book. Would you say something about that, this idea that she begins to accept herself? And that seems important for these stories, I think.
Yeah, Stephanie was raised in a very, very strictly Christian household, which was a kind of – it was a kind of fire and brimstone Christianity of an old-fashioned sort in which sins were – so deeply, you could cause God to turn away from you. You could damn yourself eternally. Sins were there were some unforgivable sins. And she grew up in this atmosphere feeling that because, of course, she sinned, like we all do, that she was never adequate, that she was always sinful and flawed and disgusting and hateful. And she did reject the specific doctrines of Christianity that she'd been raised with, but she retained for a long time the sense that there was something wrong with her, that she was sinful, that she wasn't good enough for God or for herself or for the world. And then finally, she went to see a therapist, and the therapist prescribed this book, Radical Acceptance, which was a Buddhist book. And Stephanie was not particularly interested in Buddhism, but its message was, you are okay just as you are. You are good enough. You can change. You can make yourself better. That's fine. But even if you don't, you're okay just as you are. And when she first read this, this struck her as insane. This seemed so crazy to her because it was so unlike anything she had ever thought, even though she had, as you said, tried out many different ways of thinking about morality and goodness. And then she came to think, well, maybe it's not crazy. Maybe a person like me is something like a tree, a creature, like a dog. You wouldn't say to a tree, you don't have enough leaves. You're not good enough. Or why are you an oak? You ought to be a pine. Or, you know, why are you a terrier? You ought to be a dachshund. You know, it would be crazy to say that. And she thought, well, I'm just a creature like they are. Maybe it's okay to be who I am. She's still not sure.
Yeah.
But that's what she has to live with.
Well, we didn't get to Kimberly or Paul, or there's a long list of stories. So you'll have to read Larissa Mafarker's book, Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. She joined us from a studio in New York. Larissa, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much, Doug, for having me on.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.